Hello and welcome. I'm Renee Kemp, sitting in for Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Calls Friday Media Roundtable. Today we're going to tackle two subjects, both of which have had major developments this week. First, the looming crisis in Venezuela. That country has gone from being reasonably stable and oil exporting and prosperous to being on the verge of collapse, starvation, hyperinflation, and now even possible invasion. And this week there have been growing signs that the Trump administration is actively considering a strategy to overthrow Venezuelan President Maduro, and that strategy may include invading the country to install a more U.S.-friendly government. Also, Democrats in Congress have finally assembled the House committees that they now chair, and they've started more than two dozen investigations into various aspects of Donald Trump's business and political life, from the companies to the campaign, from the inauguration to the foundation to the administration. So we're going to tackle that, too. Donald Trump under a Democratic microscope. But first, to Venezuela. It's hard to imagine, even from the most in-depth reporting, what it's like on the ground now in Venezuela. But we are fortunate to have the reporting of Chris Feliciano Arnold. He's a freelance journalist and author of The Third Bank of the River, Power and Survival in the 21st Century Amazon. Chris has been reporting on the ground from Venezuela and wrote an article in November for the Pacific Standard that literally puts you there, what it's like to be a Venezuelan who is attempting to escape the circumstances on the ground there. Chris Feliciano Arnold, thank you so much for coming into the studio.
Thank you for having me, Renee. I appreciate
it. And congratulations on the reporting that you've been doing. You don't see this kind of reporting very often anymore, and it's just remarkable. It really takes you there. And so let's start, first of all, if you've had any thoughts this week about outstanding reporting from other places, journalists.
Yeah, so thank you for having me. I think one of the challenges of finding accurate reporting on the situation of Venezuela is that this is such a polarized subject that I think that readers and listeners have to be really careful wherever they're finding their news, that they're trying to get as close to sources on the ground as possible, and that they're trying to get information that's not filtered through any particular ideology or filtered through any commentators who are trying to use the situation in Venezuela to advance their own beliefs about socialism or about U.S. interests or Russian or Chinese interests. And one thing that I've noticed in terms of a pattern of coverage, especially since the turn of this year, is just that suddenly a lot of Venezuela experts have come out of the woodwork.
Yes.
And suddenly everybody has an opinion about Chavez, about Maduro, mm-hmm. about Venezuela's past, present, and future. Mm-hmm. And so from my perspective, I guess I would just urge readers and listeners to seek out reporting on voices as close to the ground as possible, and to avoid the temptation to make any sweeping generalizations about the country, about where its people stand. Because just to give you one shade of the complexity that I've seen, as much as I'm here to talk today about the humanitarian crisis that I witnessed firsthand mm-hmm. on the border of Brazil and Venezuela during the period of election last spring. But what's astonishing is that, you know, there are still roughly, according to some polls, 20% of hardline Chavistas in Venezuela who are still, supporting the Maduro government, perhaps, or at very least the Bolivarian Revolution and its principles. And so I think it's really important for no voices to be completely drowned out and for all of us to consider not only what information we're seeing, but where that information is coming from.
And that is so challenging now.
It's become really, really difficult. Mm-hmm. I think part of it is the speed at which information travels right now. So, I've seen voices on the left and right sort of immediately parroting what could be effectively, termed as propaganda, either pro or, anti-Maduro propaganda. And one voice repeats something and it flies through the internet so quickly. And pretty soon you may have elected representatives in the U.S., saying things that essentially that there are people in the Maduro regime who would be happy to have U.S. representatives say that. And that's one of the things that I think is really difficult in terms of covering this story, is trying to be exceedingly careful about what messages advance what interests. So, for example, for years, Maduro's line has been that Venezuela is the victim of an economic war against Venezuela by the United States and its allies, that Venezuela has been the United States is constantly conspiring to invade Venezuela and conspiring to take Venezuela's natural resources.
And now,
obviously now we see a lot of things playing out. Lo and behold, a lot of that's playing out.
Yeah.
However, the way that we talk about that here in the U.S. media, I think we have to be really careful that we're not strengthening Maduro's hand by validating those messages. And so from my perspective, it's a really difficult subject to talk about. And so in my reporting, for example, I try to stay as close to the ground as possible, as close to the people as possible, and just sharing their voices, their experiences. And so in my case, for example, for this piece that you alluded to in Pacific Standard, that amounted to just spending some time in the migrant camps on the borderlands of Venezuela and Brazil, and just meeting with the thousands of everyday Venezuelans who had been pouring over. This was back in last April when the story was originally reported, but the situation's only grown worse since then. At the time, 800 Venezuelans a day were crossing the border from Venezuela to Brazil, a country where they don't even speak the language. So because the situation in terms of Venezuelans crossing to Colombia had become so desperate that more and more Venezuelans were now looking south to cross through Brazil for better options. And so for me, it was a matter of just spending as much time as possible with those individuals, hearing their stories. What were you doing in Venezuela? Why did you leave? What are you hoping to get from this journey? How is your family back home? Rather than trying to tune into the talking heads on whatever network who are trying to debate like the large-scale political ideologies that are going on.
So for American consumers of news who are looking for the best way to look at what's happening in Venezuela or news in general, it's best to look at journalists who are covering stories from the ground, from the grassroots, from the people, and that's the kind of reporting that we see so much less of now because it's long-term, it's not quick turnaround, and like Carol Rosenberg from the Miami Herald, I thought it's important to mention her, covering things on the ground in Guantanamo Bay for the last 17 years, but she's about to get either bought out or laid off.
Absolutely.
From the Miami Herald. And I thought that's the kind of reporting that we see less of, but we need to see
Absolutely.
More of.
I'm so glad you brought that out. The intensity, the time and cost of doing that sort of reporting is incredible, and we're seeing less and less of it, and it's in greater jeopardy every day, and that's exactly the kind of information we need, is information with on-the-ground perspective and historical perspective, which is why you mentioned, like, if I could steer readers towards one thing and talk about things that are time-intensive and difficult to produce. Mm-hmm. If Americans should be reading one thing on Venezuela right now, it's some history. So I would recommend, for example, this incredible biography by Maria Rana Bolivar, American Liberator, which would give American readers a really compelling several hundred page overview of the history of Venezuela and how the country got here and why. What do we mean when we talk about the Bolivarian Revolution, for example? Because right now, so much of it gets boiled down to a simplistic sort of war between socialists and capitalists, but it's so easy for American commentators to lose the historical nuance there. And I think what's really important for people to understand about why Chavistas are so deeply entrenched in holding on to power there and why the situation is so complicated is that for many Venezuelans who support the 20% or so of Venezuelans who still support Maduro, but also for many of the 80% of Venezuelans who do not support Maduro, they still believe strongly in the principle that for Venezuela and for South America broadly, there is no political sovereignty without economic sovereignty. Mm-hmm. And so when you think about a situation where you suddenly have the US, a U.S.-led international coalition deciding that they now are interested in regime change, that they're now interested in continuing to manipulate bank accounts and move funds here and finance and take control of state and natural resources in different ways, it's, I think, very menacing to both the 20% who still support Maduro, and also the 80% who are against him, because there's nothing new under the sun, and the history of U.S. intervention in Latin America is not one that has a very positive track record. And I think that as desperate as people are there for change, they're still very keenly aware of the downside.
But it's been a while since Americans were hearing anything about what's happening in that part of the world, but it's getting more and more destabilized. So since the 19th century and the Monroe Doctrine and U.S. intervention in that part of the world, you know, kind of bringing the story forward to like 2002 when Hugo Chavez was overthrown, if only for 2 days, there was U.S. intervention then. And I think that as journalists, it's important to kind of bring the story forward, but you got to give it a historical context, if for no other reason, so that Americans understand, why should I even care about this story? Well, it's because the U.S. has been up to a bit of mischief in that part of the world, and understanding where we are today requires kind of having that historical backdrop.
Absolutely. And to go back to what you were saying earlier about investments in newsrooms and investments in reporting, there's a huge difference between having a reporter on the ground in South America or anywhere and having a senior reporter on the ground who has that 20 or 30 years of depth of field when looking at these issues. And so, for example, when we see newsrooms cut back and when we see foreign coverage cut back, not only is there a cutback in just the overall investments of reporters on the ground, but oftentimes it's those senior reporters who are pushed out the door, the reporters who have that long history, the reporters who may have memory of Hugo Chavez standing on the floor of the United Nations waving a copy of Eduardo Galeano's The Open Veins of Latin America and saying that he smelled sulfur when George W. Bush walked in the room. I mean, this is the context that I think it strikes me as more important than ever for Americans to understand the connections between Latin American policy and domestic U.S. policy. I mean, if you see it, the fact that we have our administration willing to shut down the government for weeks at a time in order to build a wall on the southern border, and that this is supposed to be a flashpoint, and yet I find that more and more people are only now beginning to appreciate the links between U.S. intervention in Central and South America and the flood of migrants now at our southern border. And so it's a time for when we need deeper, more nuanced, and reporting with more historical perspective, and yet we're getting less and less of that.
And the kind of reporting that you do is the kind of reporting that kind of gives people an aha moment. You wrote for the Pacific Standard about the situation right on the border of Brazil and Venezuela. As you said, Colombia had just taken in so many that people began going to the Brazil border, even though there was a language barrier. But this is one of the ways that you describe what's happening right at that one place. It's called Boa Vista in Brazil. You say a plaza, which is where some of these migrants are gathering. A plaza is no place for a child to sleep. No water or toilets, trash piling up, drawing vermin from the shadows. People falling ill, measles, malaria, malnutrition, and pneumonia. But it was here or the street. So 25 children call Simón Bolívar Plaza home. And then you talk about what the economic picture looks like, because people's eyes glaze over when you say that the inflation rate is 1.7 million percent. Huh? What does that look like? Well, you describe that too. You say nowadays the currency exchanges prefer gold and U.S. $100 bills. Venezuelan dollars, bolivars, blow across the streets like dried leaves. Cocaine, hand grenades, and women are the only things of value crossing the border anymore. And in Caracas, an egg yolk was as good as gold. That really brings it home that people are hungry, they're starving, and their currency is totally worthless.
And that, I think, is, you mentioned people's eyes glazing over because the numbers are so eye-popping. I feel like even several years ago, we were hearing about 10,000% inflation and then 20,000%. And now, most recently, 1.7 million percent inflation. And so at this point, it becomes, what does that even mean? And I think what's one thing that was surprising to me and that I think is helpful for people to realize is that just because the currency has been devalued out of all proportion doesn't mean that there isn't still an economy. It comes down to what is being traded. One of the dangerous things about the situation in Venezuela right now is there's a lot of cocaine in that country. There's a lot of weapons floating around that country. There's also a lot of people with former military experience from both Venezuela and neighboring countries floating around with, you know, military expertise for sale, for trade. So there's a very the situation is not as simple as will Maduro stay or go? Will the military take control or not? There are a lot of different factions. There's a lot of drugs, gold, weapons, and people being floating around, and there are many more factions at play right now than simply, you know, Maduro or the opposition. There are both factions on the Chavista side competing for power, and who I could speculate are already sort of trying to game out what will happen next. Likewise, that 80% of people who are against Maduro, that's an enormous tent. That's a big opposition, and they're by no means unified in what they would like to see next or who they would like to see lead next. There are just because Maduro may go does not mean that the Bolivarian Revolution may go. There's another Hector Rodriguez, who's the governor of Miranda State there in Venezuela, is a very popular young Chavista who has a great deal of support and who's seen as a moderate Chavista there. And so there's a lot of complexity. It's not a binary outcome. And unfortunately, what we're seeing, again, history repeats itself with the Trump administration, is the notion that, you know, it's as simple as waving a magic wand or as simple as sending in troops or this or that, and that suddenly we can somehow, like, deliver freedom as if it's, like, a package from Amazon or something. It's going to be far more complex than I fear. This administration has proven that it's not ready to do to run things effectively within our own borders.
Well, there seem to be a lot of signals that the Trump administration and the leading role that it took in recognizing Juan Guaido is as the interim president, that they want a more assertive role back in Latin America after a long period of time when, there were times when you would hear the word Sandinista on the nightly news or the word Junta on the nightly news, and that we were kind of a bit more plugged in to what was happening to our south, and suddenly those kinds of concerns are back, if for no other reason but because of the wall. People are starting that whole discussion. Mm-hmm. People are asking, why are they piling up the southern border? Mm-hmm. Why are they so desperate to cross mm-hmm. through Mexico into the United States? So it's at least opening the question, the why question, right? Which is part of why you're reporting.
Yeah, and one of the reasons why is, I think, the total lack of coherence in terms of foreign policy from the Trump administration. So we've heard from them since the days of the 2016 election how important it is for the U.S. to withdraw from abroad, how the U.S. should not be out there policing other countries, how the U.S. needs to be focused on, you know, its own priorities. And yet, here we have a coalition building to lead into a new level of intervention in Latin America that we haven't seen in decades. And I think it comes down to a lack of coherent strategy that we've seen across the board policy-wise, but also a vacuum of leadership. We've heard reporting for months, for years, about the lack of leadership at the State Department, about the loss of senior diplomats. What's happened in this case is that essentially Marco Rubio of Florida is now the, for lack of a better word, like the Deputy Secretary of State for Latin America right now. Mm-hmm. A lot of what we're seeing right now is the result of Marco Rubio sort of pounding the table on this Venezuela issue for very opportunistically for a year and a half now. And so what we have is really assertive policy decisions being made without the requisite experience, depth of history, and thought and strategy being put into it. And so we're tumbling very rapidly as a country right now into what could potentially be a real mess in Latin America.
And so often American news consumers think that things just happen sort of spontaneously, like, a dumpster fire. But no, there are things that have been happening quietly mm-hmm. behind the scenes. For example, AP is reporting that in mid-December, Guaido quietly traveled to Washington, Colombia, and Brazil. He briefed officials in those countries, including here in the U.S., on his strategy of mass demonstrations to coincide with Maduro's expected swearing-in in January, right? So there were machinations behind the scenes that led up to the images that we're now beginning to see. And so it didn't happen spontaneously. Mm-hmm. This is planned. This is coordinated. This is orchestrated. Mm-hmm. And the United States has a hand in it, yes?
Absolutely. And you mentioned Guaido visiting the United States. There have been There's some reporting in the New York Times from summer of last year that the members of the Trump administration had been meeting with military officials in Venezuela, contemplating the possibility of a coup. Essentially, a lot of these, as you mentioned, a lot of these changes have been orchestrated for a long time, and the U.S. Trying to supposedly weigh the best of bad options. But it all, for me, it boils down to why must the U.S. be taking these steps to begin with? Under what premise is our government operating that it's our role to play here, and that it's our role to fill here? In my opinion, it's one way, yet another way that the Trump administration is like very opportunistically essentially trying to make a demonstration of its show of strength against the forces of socialism. Because let's say one place where we have heard Venezuela a lot is on the campaign trail for years now, is candidates talk about not wanting the United States to go the way of Venezuela, et cetera, et cetera. Venezuela is not a talking point for U.S. elections. It's a country with millions of people who deserve to shape their own sovereign destiny. And the danger of the U.S. sort of setting foreign policy in this way is that it essentially, regardless of what the future holds for the Venezuelan people right now, the mere fact that the U.S. has been meddling for months and years, but also has now made its intervention so public, is that whatever happens next, the popular uprising in Venezuela, whether it's led by Juan Guaido or led by someone else, has been irrevocably tainted by the U.S.'s involvement now. And whatever long road ahead lies in wait for the Venezuelan people, the specter of the U.S. involvement here is going to hang over and taint that political debate for years and for decades. And that, for me, is the saddest part about this outcome, is that those voices have essentially been co-opted now by the U.S. intervention.
And possible invasion. I think when, I don't know, was it accidental? I still wonder if when John Bolton had that notepad turned around and it said 5,000 troops to Colombia, ? Do you think that was on purpose? Is it kind of priming the pump and getting the discussion out there, sort of a trial balloon? I don't know. A conspiracy theory. But the fact is, it looks like it's a serious consideration. Yeah. Could the U.S. invade Venezuela? Yeah.
Whether it was intentional or not, I think what it shows is just the lack of respect and seriousness with which our leaders are treating this situation. For John Bolton to just get up there haphazardly with a notebook, and that if that is the extent of our next steps in Venezuela, is a couple lines on a legal pad, that just goes to show where we are right now. And whether he was just doing it to, you know, whether that was psyops and it was intentional or whether it wasn't, it just goes to show that for them this is like a really interesting game of chess or something, when on the ground in Venezuela there are millions of people who have been and who will continue to suffer from this, and in their desperation many of them are even looking to the United States for some sort of assistance and help. And the fact that we have our country has sort of this parlor of misfit toys to offer as the leaders to help them out in this situation is just, it's incredibly sad. I do think if I could leave listeners with one thing, it would be that this situation is deeply complicated. I don't purport to be a Venezuela expert. I will say, though, that it is true that the regime, you can hold both things to be true. Nicolas Maduro's regime is dictatorial. It's caused unprecedented suffering in the country and in the region. And the United States should not be taking a leading role in regime change in the country. It's difficult to hold those two things in your head at the same time, but that's one of the most complex and heartbreaking parts of this situation, is that it's unsustainable, it's a catastrophe, and yet the United States should not be the ones drawing up the game plan, because we've seen what's happened and with that in the past, and I'm afraid we may see that again in the future.
No one has done a better job of describing that catastrophe. I mean, when I read your work, I can smell the fetid smells. I can see children crying and mothers in distress. I can feel like I'm there. Are you going back anytime soon?
My wife and I just welcomed a baby girl into the world just a few weeks ago, and so I'll be staying home for a while. But I do look forward to continuing to follow this story very closely. And I want to thank you again for having me today.
Absolutely. Chris Feliciano Arnold. And you can read his article in the Pacific Standard. It's called Letter from Boa Vista, Brazil, Exodus from Venezuela. His work will take you there. And want to thank you so much for being there. When we come back, we're going to take a break. We're going to talk to Craig Unger. He's a contributing editor at Vanity Fair, author of several books. We're going to talk to him about the latest developments in the ongoing investigations into Donald Trump. Stay with us.
This is Your Call, a show that's better when you get involved. If you have a question, idea, or experience to contribute to today's conversation, call 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK, toll free. You can also send an email to yourcallradio@klw.org, or leave a comment at the show's website. Set a bookmark for yourcallradio.org, and you can also tweet us at yourcallradio. Our further roundup of the week's news coming your way for 1A at 11. Stay with us here on KLW.
Welcome back. For those of you just joining us, I'm Renee Kemp, sitting in for Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call's Friday Media Roundtable. We are podcasting our show. You can find more information at yourcallradio.org. You can also listen to past shows there in the archive, and we invite you to sign up for the newsletter to find out what's coming up next. And if you have a show idea, drop us a line at yourcall@kalw.org or give us a call, 866-798-8255, and you can also leave your comment on the website. That's at yourcallradio.org. Right now, we're going to switch gears and talk about what's happening in the Trump investigations and the Mueller investigations and the investigations being launched by a newly democratically led House of Representatives. We're joined by Craig Unger. He's a contributing editor at Vanity Fair, and their reporting has been pretty remarkable on these issues. And Craig is also author of several books, including House of Bush, House of Saud, which, by the way, I thought was a remarkable book when he wrote it. His new book is called House of Trump, House of Putin, The Untold Story of Donald Trump and the Russian Mafia. And it's as interesting as it sounds. Okay, thanks a lot for being with us, Craig. Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
You bet. So, you were recently quoted in an interview on Newsnight about the Trump-Russia scandal. You said the Trump-Russia scandal is starting to unravel. What did you mean?
Well, now that the Democrats finally have control of the House of Representatives, I think you're going to see some real oversight. And I'm particularly interested in what will happen with the House Intelligence Committee, which is just getting started with Adam Schiff running it. And frankly, I mean, one of the amazing things that if people have been so impatient waiting for Mueller to issue his report. But one thing of enormous interest that happened this week is when the Republicans were running the House Intelligence Committee, they just downright refused to deliver testimony to the special counsel, to Robert Mueller. And once the Democrats took over in January, the Republicans continued to stonewall, and they refused to appoint any members to the House Intelligence Committee just to delay things, to run out the clock. Finally, we do have a House Intelligence Committee underway as of this week, and one of the first things they did was to deliver the sworn testimony that had been done in closed session of 19 witnesses to Special Counsel Robert Mueller. And I think it's terribly important because this includes testimony from people like Donald Trump Jr., Jared Kushner, and so forth. And if Mueller is going to file perjury charges against them, he obviously needs that testimony.
Adam Schiff, there is a new sheriff in town. And is he ever putting the Trump administration on notice that indeed the way that intelligence committee is going to be conducted is going to be quite different? And I thought that this was quite the opening salvo, sending those transcripts of those closed-door sessions to Mueller and his team. I mean, if ever there was, I don't know, I don't mean to sound pejorative, but if ever there was a perjury trap, I'd say that's it, right?
But the perjury trap means asking questions and expecting an honest answer. And I think it's just remarkable that the Republicans, the entire party, was so obstructionist that they would simply not deliver sworn testimony to a duly appointed special counsel like Robert Mueller. I mean, it says to me all they care about is obstructing justice.
Well, it seemed, at least in the public testimony, that there was an awful lot of invoking of executive privilege. I'm just not going to answer. I'm just not going to answer. Who's to say that whatever those transcripts hold, it's not just more of that? Maybe they didn't perjure them, risk perjuring themselves. Maybe they just didn't answer very much.
Well, that's possible. I think we don't know the answer, and I hope that in the end all this will be released.
According to the New York Times, there were more than 100 in-person meetings and phone calls and text messages and emails and private messages and tweets that are being plowed through by the democratically led committees. To what extent, Craig, do you think that there is so much going on? There's something like 26 investigations happening in various committees. There's so many strings to be pulled on. How are news consumers supposed to kind of keep up with this?
You know, that's a really good question. And frankly, that's why I wrote my book, is I think we're being inundated with one fragment after another, and it's all atomized. It's very hard for normal people to put it through and see a long-range, wide-arcing narrative. And I believe this goes back more than 35 years. So that you mentioned that the Times had 100 contacts. I believe that's just during the campaign. But I go back to the early 80s when Donald Trump when the Russian mafia first used Donald Trump's real estate to launder money. And I'm hoping that's one of the things that Adam Schiff will get to in the House Intelligence Committee hearings. That is the use of the use of Donald Trump's real estate to launder money. And I believe it's been going on for a long, long time, that there are hundreds of millions, perhaps billions of dollars there. And if you want to know how and why the Russian mafia, that Russia really owns Donald Trump, you have to go back that far.
You know, I noticed you didn't use the A word, alleged, when you're talking money laundering and these things. It doesn't appear that there is anything
Well, you're absolutely right, and I rephrased it at the last minute because it's very difficult to convict Donald Trump like that for money laundering. But the state attorney general of New York did say that the incident I was citing in 1984 was an act of money laundering. But to convict the seller of the real estate, you have to prove that he's knowledgeable. I can't get into Donald Trump's mind. I can't prove what he was thinking at that time. However, there is, and I'm not a lawyer, but there is a legal principle of deliberate blindness, willful ignorance. And a good prosecutor would have to prove a pattern there. And I think that's quite possible because we know this happened at least 1,300 times with Donald Trump's condos. And it's one thing to say, oh, it's just a coincidence. He sold these to the Russian mafia, and then it was an all-cash purchase through an anonymous shell company. Yes, that happens occasionally when you own thousands of condos and are selling them. But 1,300 times, I think that's more than a coincidence.
You know, so far it appears that whether because, you know, he's brilliant, a genius, or just by dint of how his business is constructed, there seems to be several degrees of separation between him and any chicanery Do you think that's built in based on what you know about how he's always done business? Has he always had a buffer or some insulation between him and any potential illegal behaviors?
Absolutely. His first real lawyer was Roy Cohn, who was sort of the dark satanic prince of the McCarthy era. And with Cohn and with Roy Cohn and later with Michael Cohn, Trump, I think has a clear pattern of using attorney-client privilege as a buffer, and he makes his lawyers go operational. They take part in it, and then they say, well, they can't discuss it because it happened under attorney-client privilege.
Sounds like a brilliant strategy, if you ask me.
Yeah, no, I think that the more you look at Donald Trump's personal finances, the more you see what a myth it was. He, you may remember during the campaign, he said he got a small loan from his father of just $1 million. Well, it wasn't a loan, and it wasn't $1 million. As the Times, New York Times later showed, it was over $400 million when you adjust for inflation and see all the various chicanery in their financial dealings. So I don't know how many of your listeners have given over $400 million from their parents, but that's not a small loan. And it wasn't a loan, by the way.
Well, given that he seems to have built up these firewalls with activist attorneys who actively get out in front and buffers and degrees of separation, we know that he doesn't use email. So for people who might be waiting for this big gotcha moment, is it possible that he has enough insulation that that just isn't going to happen?
Well, I think there'll be a lot more indictments, but I think you're raising a really good question, because I think no matter how good the Mueller report is, and I really hope to see it, and I think that there will be a lot more indictments with it, but no matter how good it is, I think part of the problem here is what is legal. And when we talk about money laundering, for example, part of the problem is that regulations in the real estate industry are so lax that it's very, very easy to launder money legally. And by the same token, you can look in various other industries. Look at the big law firms in D.C., the big white shoe law firms like Jones Day. They represent dozens of Russian oligarchs, and they, in addition, they have 12 partners who are in the White House counsel's office defending Trump. That's true of many of the big law firms. It's true of a lot of the K Street lobbyists. I mean, as a reporter on this stuff, I've seen for decades, you see the big K Street firms that have represented big oil or big pharmaceutical companies. And I think many people know, of course, that they then lobby Congress to try to get favorable laws for their industries. Well, the Russians figured that out as well, and they started doing it too. And you see, like, people like Paul Manafort, who has represented not just big companies of various industries like that, but he's represented dictators from the Philippines, from Somalia, and so forth. And he was, I mean, Black Manafort Stone, and the stone was Roger Stone, was known as the dictator's lobby, the torturer's lobbies, and they sort of reveled in the sleaze of it. I interviewed Roger Stone several times on this. Well, eventually they took it a step forward, and effectively they started working for Vladimir Putin. When Paul Manafort was in Ukraine, he was doing Putin's bidding. He was getting tens of millions of dollars from Putin's oligarchs, and the idea was they wanted to install Viktor Yanukovych, who was very much a Putin puppet, as president of Ukraine, and they succeeded for a while, though he was eventually thrown out. And in many ways, I see that as a precursor of what has happened with the 2016 election here. Again, you have Manafort as the campaign manager installing a pro-Putin puppet in the presidency, but this time it's the White House.
Well, you know, it's interesting that these, I noticed you didn't use the word alleged to describe any of those machinations, because that's provable. We had the book showing where Manafort was on the payroll in Ukraine. I mean, there's actual proof of that. But it appears to me, Craig, what's happening, as so often happens, is it's not the crime, it's the lies. So, for example, the Democratic chairman of two House committees have promised to investigate a report that Donald Trump directed his personal attorney, Michael Cohen, to lie to Congress about negotiations over that Moscow real estate project during the 2016 election. So to what extent is it not so much what happened, but the lies about what happened that could be the trap?
Right. Well, you're absolutely right. And if you go back to Watergate, that's how Richard Nixon came undone. If you recall, there was there was the 18.5-minute gap in a tape that Richard Nixon had secretly made, and they had the cover up of that became unraveled. So that is frequently a way, I think, when prosecutors start investigations and starting to unravel them. And they catch people in perjury when they start to find the lies, and try to flip them. And they start with the lowest hanging fruit, with the people at the bottom of the pyramid, and sort of work their way up. And I think we're now at a stage where you're going to see, is Donald Jr. or Jared Kushner going to be indicted? And when that happens, you see it getting closer and closer. You're finally inside Donald Trump's family, and that will put real pressure on it. And at the same time, for all that, I guess what I try to write about is, what is it they're trying to hide? What are the underlying crimes? How, something really happened there. When did it start? How did it begin? And how did Russia come to compromise Donald Trump and begin to manipulate him?
Well, it appears that so far there's not actually a smoking gun, but we do know that there were these meetings that were denied and lied about, and it took place during the campaign, during the transition, after the swearing in, well into the beginning parts of the administration. So I'm assuming that Robert Mueller is looking into all these different parts, but the fact remains, so far, no smoking gun. And I guess my question, Craig, has to do with the fact that if it's if they're looking to find out what Trump's involvement was, they've got to try to look into his head and figure out what was his intent. And how do you ever figure that out? How can they possibly know what his intentions were?
Well, I mean, there's always money is one of them. I mean, I think the amount of money he ended up, I mean, if you look at it, I mean, even after that tremendous boost from his father with over $400 million, Trump went into Atlantic City, and he emerged with six bankruptcies and totaling $4 billion in debt. So what happened next? Well, the Russians came to his aid. And you see, Bayrock Group was a real estate firm that was real estate development company that was actually in Trump Tower, located on the 24th floor there. And they started partnering with Trump and made him a deal he couldn't refuse. So they made him rich again. This is a couple of years before The Apprentice started, and they helped bring him back. So he was completely in their debt to an enormous extent.
My guess is that a lot of your investigation technique has to do with following the money. How important was that, and has that been in your investigation of Trump and his inner workings?
Well, absolutely. It's sort of a tried and true format. I you know, when I started on this, I was told, someone who'd worked in the former Soviet Union told me, oh, you know, this is all about Trump's relation with Semyon Mogilevich, who's a very famous and powerful mobster in the Russian mafia. And to be honest, I'd never heard of him at that point, but I immediately went back home and I got onto a database on the internet that shows the purchase and sale of all these, of every apartment and every home in New York State. And of course, I focused on Trump's holdings. And when I got to them, I started writing out every Russian sounding name I could, and I just saw started Googling and saw how many of them were tied to the Russian mafia. And this became extraordinary. You started seeing that the Russians made overtures to Trump a lot in the early 80s. And I think there's a good case to be made that he was compromised by them back in 86 and 87 when he made his first trip he had just been involved in that early money laundering with the Russian mafia in 1984. In 1986, Ambassador Dubinin, who was a Soviet ambassador to the United Nations at the time, went to Trump Tower, met with Trump, invited him to Moscow, and said, "We've got to have a Trump Tower in Moscow, just like the beautiful building you've built here." I then interviewed a general in the KGB, Oleg Kalugin, who told me he believed that Trump was compromise on Trump from that first visit in Moscow. And then you see Trump in Moscow trying to make these deals again and again. And I think there's a good case to be made that that is when Trump was first compromised.
If you're just joining us, Craig Unger is a contributing editor at Vanity Fair, and he's author of House of Trump, House of Putin, The Untold Story of Donald Trump and the Russian Mafia. It seems to me, once again, because following the money is so often just a good approach, whether you are Robert Mueller and his investigators or a good investigative reporter like yourself, following the money is often the best approach, which is really interesting now that the Democrats are running the House of Representatives and all the committees they're in. They're going to try to get his taxes. Do you have an idea of what they're going to find in your investigative reporting? Do you have a clue or a hint already as to what's lurking there?
Well, I'm not an expert on taxes at all, and I'm not sure what will show up there. What I hope is, I don't know how he structured his taxes, but you do want to see the extent to which there is Russian money in there. And how it's reported. I mean, one of the frustrations as a reporter in doing all this is obviously I can't get his taxes, but I also don't have subpoena power. So I can see that there are hundreds and hundreds of shell companies who are paying money to Donald Trump, but I don't know who's in those shell companies. And I'm hoping that perhaps the tax is formed, if the House Oversight Committee gets them, will start to reveal that.
Well, the Oversight Committee made that not the first order of business, but certainly the second. They didn't waste any time trying to get access to those taxes. But, you know, it seems to me that because there may have been a real surprise, even amongst the Trumps themselves, that he actually ended up becoming president, that all of the things that might turn out to be problematic may be very well hiding in plain sight, not to mention that after 2 years of very little oversight, that there's a real hubris at work here, where things probably should have been hidden better and weren't. So is there anything that you think is just kind of waiting, hanging out there, waiting for the Democrat-controlled House and their committees to discover that you've already found in your untold stories of, for example, his connections to the Russian mafia?
Absolutely. I mean, and I do think it is hiding in plain sight, and this is sort of what astounded me. I live in New York, and anyone who knows New York knows that Fifth Avenue and 58th Street or 59th Street, wherever Trump Tower is a pretty fancy neighborhood, and Trump Tower is one of the glitziest buildings in town. You do not expect it to be a high crime area. And the truth is, Trump Tower has, on and off, been a headquarters for the Russian mafia for more than 35 years. So I reported, and these crimes have been reported again and again. No one before has linked them together. And to me, what's interesting is not so much the individual crimes, the money laundering in 1984, the fact that a guy named Vaclav Ivankov, a real murderous and powerful figure in the Russian mafia, the FBI was looking all over for him in Brooklyn, and instead he lived in Trump Tower. You have in 2013 the bust of two massive money laundering rings and gambling rings in Trump Tower. This happened again and again. You have his casinos being used to launder money, and he was comping Russian mobsters over the years. So when you put that together with the fact that the Russian mafia is very, very different from the Italian-American mafia we're more familiar with in the United States. The Russian mafia is a state actor. I interviewed General Kalugin about this, and he said, oh, they're just another branch of the KGB. They serve at Vladimir Putin's pleasure, and they are working in and partnering with and operating out of Trump Tower, the President of the United States. I think that is deeply, deeply disturbing and a spectacular breach in security.
Talk about hiding in plain sight. You know, it seems to me, Craig, as we start to wind up, that this story has so many tentacles. I mean, the most recent developments with perhaps pressure from AMI and the National Enquirer and a man named Pecker on Jeff Bezos, who owns the Washington Post, to maybe possibly stop posting negative stories about Trump. Who knows? But, I mean, the NRA and real estate deals. How do you keep people plugged in and tuned in to the saga?
Well, I look at this as a global conflict, and I think most people don't, and they're slowly becoming aware of it. I titled the first chapter Virtual World War III, and when I first wrote that, I thought, am I going too far? Now I think I haven't gone far enough. And this is a war without bombs or bullets or boots on the ground, and I think it means most people can go about their business blissfully ignorant. But the truth is, it's a war using cyber warfare, using hacking, using disinformation. There's an assault on the media. There's all sorts of fake news. And I mean the opposite of what Donald Trump means when I say that. It's very, very hard. I think our media system has been fragmented and atomized in part by the internet. And the Russians have learned exactly how to exploit that. They've done it especially well with doing that with Facebook, with social media, which is Facebook in many ways is a major purveyor of Russian propaganda. And I think people have to become alert to that. I think a lot of parts of the media have to wake up a bit that a lot of this story is not yet in the mainstream. But, as you say, a lot of it is hiding in plain sight.
Craig Unger, contributing editor at Vanity Fair, author of House of Trump, House of Putin, The Untold Story of Donald Trump and the Russian Mafia. Thanks so much for being here. Appreciate you.
Thanks for having me.
You bet. Also want to thank Chris Feliciano Arnold, freelance journalist, author of The Third Bank of the River, Power and Survival in the 21st Century Amazon, for bringing us up to speed on the human and political crisis in Venezuela. Thank you for joining us. Malihe Razazan produced today's show. Phil Hartman is the chief engineer. David LaTulipe is the studio engineer. Thank you for being here. I'm Renee Kemp, sitting in for Rose Aguilar. It's your call.